Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Zeros TV and another episode of The Chopping Block. Today, I'm joined by JR of Jehoshaphat Research, who's asked to remain anonymous for this report. JR, thanks for joining me today.
Of course, Mike. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here again.
All right. So tell us, who's up on The Chopping Block today?
So today we're going to be talking about Progyny. Progyny is a third-party administrator of fertility benefits. They're a U.S. listed stock. They have a few billion dollars in market cap, and we're short them because we believe that their financials are grossly misrepresented. And then also the business has challenges that are facing it over the coming years. So those things combine to make us really like this short. You know, number one, we believe the only reason Progyny shows a profit or positive cash flows is because of creative accounting. And so, you know, and worse, you know, we believe that we found proof of management secretively changing certain accounting policies, important policies, to paper over the fact that their quote unquote real margins and cash flows are deteriorating. You know, the other aspect to our thesis is just the reason the company needs to play all these accounting games is that this business is just terrible. It looks profitable. It looks like it generates cash. Our analysis says it doesn't do either of those things. It's just accounting smoke and mirrors that makes it look like it does. But what does it mean when you have a business that can't do those things? And it's not a small business, right? They have 4 million covered lives. They've been in business for years. This company also has to take 100% of the credit risk of the provider clinics that it partners with, but they only get like about 20% of the associated revenues of those provider clinics. So they concentrate and they magnify credit risk. And that involves, they take a lot of risk to do that. And we think that that's also showing up in their financial statements in the way that you don't want it to show up. You know, also fundamentally, there's very few potential clients, companies, corporations, for whom this type of specialized fertility benefit makes sense. So if Progyny is going to keep growing, let alone growing at the rate it's been growing, which is very fast, its margins are going to just keep deteriorating because the clients they have to go after are far less profitable, even than the ones they have now. And we think that they don't make money now. So we think that that's just going to keep getting worse. We also just don't think they can find enough new accounting games to keep hiding it. So there's a lot wrong here. We think the accounting is the signal or the evidence that this business is really troubled. You could be short for either reason. We think both of them combined make it a phenomenal short.
Let's start with the financial gimmicks or creative games that you say that they're playing. What has your work found, and what sort of games do you think they are actually playing?
I mean, to start with, the sell side thinks that this company, you know, if you read sell side research on this company from major research firms, the analysts think that this company is a revenue growth story, a margin growth story, and a good cash flow story. And just every piece of that is just chock full of accounting games. You know, in our opinion, it's just nonsense. And we think that as much as 900 basis points of this company's gross margin is just accounting magic. The company would not be reporting that much, that amount of margin, if the company weren't using such creative accounting. That's our opinion. The company's also made meaningful and secretive. I mean, they disclose it, but you really have to dig to find it. I mean, you have to do stuff that we don't think anybody else is doing, to dig through their filings and make comparisons to say, oh, they had this very tiny, subtle change that really has a major impact on financials, we think. So that's really spring-loaded the performance. And it's given the appearance of stable and growing earnings. But we think that without these accounting changes that they've recently made, you would see the real underlying performance of this business. It's falling off a cliff. I mean, it looks really bad to us. So that's kind of the financial misrepresentation picture.
So what are some of those changes that they've made? As you mentioned, it's not easy to spot, but you know, for someone like yourself who kind of pours over the 10Ks or 10Qs and can spot those subtle changes, what are some of those specific changes they've made, and what impact has that had to whether it's revenue growth or margin growth?
Yeah, so you know, one change that they made, this is one that was super subtle, but really just, we think, just totally black and white, and had an immediate impact on the numbers. They changed their method for calculating certain costs from using historical to using expected gross margins. And literally, you know, you can do a black line of the 10K. We do this in our report, and you can see how they changed from one 10K to the next. The word historical is crossed out, and the word expected now shows up. And this doesn't sound like a big deal, but because of Progyny's accounting, they use an accounting method, a type of accrual accounting, where they can accrue revenues and profits today based on things they expect are going to happen in the future. Now, the presence of that accounting by itself is not quote unquote wrong, but it leaves open the possibility of you can do a lot with that. If you want to be bad, you can be really bad with that type of accounting. It's very subjective. This accounting change allowed them, you know, our analysis says, because we also see the evidence in the numbers, right after the same quarter that change happened, the same exact, you know, I believe it was Q1 21, I think it may have been Q4 21, the exact quarter that they made that change, their gross margins on, you know, certain transactions went up dramatically. We think that change added around 400 basis points to their gross margin and is still doing so today. You see the change, you see the language change, you see it right in the numbers right away, and you can do some fairly simple math once you know that this exists. That's the hard part, is knowing that it exists. Once you know it exists, it's not hard to do the math and see that, you know, you can see the impact that it had. It really flatters income. And you have to ask yourself, and we do this analysis, what would their margins look like if they hadn't made this change? You know, another change that they made, also fairly recent, this is a little bit more complex, but you can see just things disappearing from the 10Ks. And then you can see language changes around that. You can see the numbers also, the numeric output also changing at the same time. So the company used to record allowances. For viewers that are familiar with contra revenues, it's not a bad debt allowance, but these are allowances that sort of function like bad debt. The company used to record allowances against revenues, against receivables, for when customers would cancel their appointments. And then one day, you know, based on our read of the filings, the tables, half of, you know, footnotes disappearing, tables in the financial statements disappearing, the balance sheet just numbers changing retroactively, it looks like they just stopped recording those allowances. They wiped them from all the mentions in the accounting language. They even have a section where they talk about critical accounting estimates, and that the part about the allowances for these cancellations just went away. It's just crossed out in the red line. And the same quarter they did that, you know, if you thought a company was playing accounting games by stopping the accrual of allowances, the same what you'd look for is a spike in certain types of receivables. And the exact same quarter they did that, the associated receivables just exploded. I mean, they were talking about on a day's revenue basis, they doubled year, they more than doubled year over year. It sticks out like a sore thumb when you go back and do the sort of year over year comparisons. And so we think that's also adding. We're not exactly sure how much this one is helping. You have to make a couple assumptions to estimate what it's doing. But we think that's adding as much as another 400 basis points or so to revenue and also to gross margins. You know, the next, you know, there's one more change that we've identified. This isn't so much an accounting change as it's a change in funding, but it's sort of accounting related or accounting light. If you look at their cash flow from operations, it looks like this company just reliably produces positive operating cash flows. But something major changed in their financing and their funding of their cash flows. And it's actually really simple. You don't have to always be, this is something that anybody can look at if they know what to look for. The company started firing up a stock compensation program. And so, you know, since they've been public, they've paid, and before we believe they've paid employees in stock. But they started paying a lot of stock comp. So much that if you basically look at cash flow from operations, excluding stock comp, it used to be modestly positive. It was never robust, but at least it was modestly positive. But excluding that stock comp, it's degraded to the point where now it's massively negative. And we have a chart where we sort of summarize this finding in our report. Underlying cash from operations has fallen off a cliff. And the only reason you don't see that is because the company has started paying employees in a lot, much larger amounts of stock. Stock compensation is just a funding mechanism, right? You issue stock to employees instead of paying them in cash. And this really can present problems for companies that are dependent on it because, you know, if your stock price goes down, you have to issue a lot more stock. If your stock price gets cut in half, you have to issue, it's not one-to-one, but let's call it 100% more stock to keep paying those employees, unless you just start laying people off, which is not a great scenario either. So they've made these changes to their accounting and their financing programs, and it's really enabled them to sort of keep their numbers from imploding. Right now, we do this analysis in our report where we say, here's what gross margins would look like and gross profits if they didn't do these things. here's what cash flows would look like if they didn't do these things. It's really ugly. And it makes you have to ask the question, what is going on here that this company, their underlying financial performance is imploding? So we're short, that's a big part of our short thesis.
Well, if I can just press you a little bit on that. I know you mentioned it's in your report, but what would margins look like? Because I know on those first two examples that you mentioned, they're about 400 basis points for each one. So what are margins, taken into the benefit of those? And then if you strip those out to what it should be, I mean, are we looking at 30% down to 26%?
Sure.
22%? Or what's sort of the delta overall there and the underlying level where it should be?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm glad you asked that. The company reports low 20s gross, low, 21, 22% type gross margins. Based on our analysis, we estimate that the real gross margins of this company are more like in the low teens. There's a little bit of wiggle room there, but you're looking at, we have a chart in our report where we sort of do this analysis a little bit more crisply, but I'm just going to say, call it from 22 down to 12 or 13%. This is not a high margin company to begin with. A low 20s gross margin it's not a lot of profit to play with. But if the company were doing a 13%, let's say, gross margin, we think they lose money, because that's the difference in those two gross margins is greater than their entire operating margin. And I'll add, and this, we'll get to this hopefully as we talk, is that we've spoken to, we spoke to a former employee, we spoke to a industry benefit consultant. The experts in this industry, the people who know this company and have been in this space for years and know Progyny really well, it makes them scratch their heads as to how this company can generate a 21% gross margins. It doesn't make sense to them. I had one former employee who just told me, I don't see how it's possible. It left me and my colleagues scratching our heads. So we think that the fact that this company's gross margins triangulate more like in the low teens or something around there, it's not a strange number at all. Because if you talk to people, you do the field interviews, you talk to people that really understand this business, not sell side analysts who just will tell you whatever the company tells them, or the company, which, you should ask the company if you want to know what they think, but you know what they're going to say. And don't take our word for it either, right? Go, talk, viewers should do their own homework on the fundamentals, like we've done. We do our analysis, we make it as clear as we can in our report. And then we would invite the people that are so inclined, professional investors especially, take the time to talk to people who understand this business, and you'll find a lot of questions about gross margins. We don't think it's a coincidence that we're thinking that gross margins of this company are actually a lot lower than what the company says they are, and they triangulate around, give or take, what experts in this field kind of think the gross margins are supposed to be. So that gives us added confidence, necessary to fill in for our confidence, that we think that these gross margins are drastically overinflated, and we think we know what they're more realistically achieving.
So since you brought it up, what were some of those discussions that you had, whether it was with former employees or industry experts? I mean, what did they actually say to you?
They said a lot. We did a number of calls like this. We spoke to a lot of people, but some of our favorite findings, maybe my personal favorite, I spoke to a former employee who just hammered home this idea from so many different perspectives that he couldn't understand the numbers that this company reported when he was there. After he left, his colleagues couldn't understand these numbers. He told a story about he would go to these town halls, back before they went public. He would go to these town halls where they would get together and they'd say, okay, this is what we did this quarter, or this is what we're going to do next quarter. This is the way that the margins are shaping up, the revenues. And the way he explained it to us is, look, they would put these numbers out that made no sense to him. This person who worked at this company was doing the ROI modeling. He was out there, working on the sales, working on the contracts. He knew all the big new customers that they had sold. He knew on the ground what this company was doing in actual business. And then he would go to these town hall meetings where the CEO and the CFO would get up there and they would say, this is what we did. And he just could not tie them out. His words, I couldn't tie them out. You can imagine what that sounded like to us doing the research that we're doing. And this guy's telling us, look, I worked there for a long time. I was in the numbers. They didn't make any sense to me. And he would go and ask, another thing he said to us was, he would go and ask the CEO or whoever, members of management, and they would just kind of tell him to go away. Like they would say, like, oh, you're asking about the past, we're looking to the future, or oh, you're asking about revenues, why are you focused on revenues? Like, look how good our margins are. And it was always just sort of like this deflection game. Now, this is secondhand. we're reporting what a former employee told us, but what he told us did not really conflict with what we were finding in the numbers. You know, this sort of man behind the curtain, Wizard of Oz thing. Don't look over there. Don't worry about that. Like, you know, this is focus here, right? And that's just, when you see that, a lot of accounting frauds and historical blowups, there's a lot of, there's little warning signs like that. When people say, I can't make sense of these numbers, people who should know, who should be able to make sense of these numbers can't do it. Another person we spoke to is a competitor. She works for a leading competitor to Progyny. And we read to her, we explained to her how low, we actually read, I should say, the revenue recognition policies from the 10K. And she literally laughed. She said, I believe the quote was, wow, okay, that's not a thing. You know, at our company, we do not recognize revenues that way, but maybe we should. And, you know, she was laughing when she said that. Obviously, she was kidding. But the point being, like, wow, if we could recognize revenues that way, our revenues would be a lot higher, I think was what she was getting at. So that was another fun conversation. You know, we also spoke to a fertility benefits consultant, an HR expert who specializes in fertility benefits. She's not a financial expert, she's not an expert on Progyny's financials, but she knows what the gross margins of these fertility benefits managers are. She knows the business model. She knows what the markups are. And we told her Progyny's reported gross margins, and her words were, well, that's surprising. And she just couldn't make heads or tails of it either. She could sort of speculate as to how that could be possible, but it didn't really make intuitive sense to her. So we had, a lot of people telling us the same thing. The accounting is really aggressive and the numbers don't make sense. And that's also what we think based on our analysis. If you don't have a dime to your name, or you don't have the time to go out and talk to former employees of these companies to call people up, but that's not what you do. You want to stick to the numbers. We believe you're going to find the same thing. But we always try to triangulate our work by talking to people who've been around these companies longer than we have. When they tell us the same thing that we're finding in the numbers, it's pretty compelling.
So speaking of the numbers, I think it's a good point to now pivot towards your second key pillar in your thesis here, which is sort of the bad debts picture. And I think once you explain it, it'll help people understand that it could also tie into the financial gimmicks, as you called them. So tell us what you found with the bad debts and what you think might be going on.
Yeah, so we, it's when I looked at this company, and I'm going to explain this in sort of a, my experience of researching this thing. And what would it look like to me? Because I think that'll help investors who want to recreate, follow in our footsteps if they want to recreate this research. When I looked at the balance sheet of this company and the cash flow statement, a couple of things jumped out at me that just didn't make any sense. And they still don't make any sense. From the beginning, they made no sense. This company has a really large bad debt allowance. I think as of the last quarter, it had something like $25 million of allowance against receivables for bad debts. And its bad debt expense, which you can go to and find in the cash flow statement, the bad debt expenses are really large as a percentage of revenues. I don't understand, we still don't understand, and neither do former, we spoke to a former employee who doesn't understand how this company can have so much bad debt. The reason is, the reason is its companies are Google, and its client companies are Google and Facebook. And the vast majority of these companies' revenues do not come from the members. The members have co-payments and deductibles, out-of-pocket maximums, but there's even a sell-side report talking about how this company has very little of its payments are due from members, so it shouldn't have any bad debt expense. The sell-side report actually thinks that the analyst actually says this company has very little bad debt. Now, we went and did this analysis because this didn't smell right to us. We looked at the bad debt of all the bad debt expense as a percentage of revenues to all of the company's peers that it identifies in its proxy filing. And none of those companies have bad debt expenses. Progyny has the highest bad debt expense to revenues based on our calculations. Sometimes they don't call it bad debt expense. They might call it provision for credit losses or something like that. But when we do this analysis, we find that Progyny is the absolute top of the peer group in terms of bad debt expense to revenues. And a lot of the companies have no bad debt expense or very, very little, like trace amounts of bad debt. We also compared Progyny's bad debt expense to pharmacy benefit managers, which are companies that we think have a business model. They're not cherry-picked peers that Progyny puts in its own proxy. They're actually companies that we think have a much more similar business model to Progyny. Those companies have almost no bad debt, and then Progyny just sticks out like a sore thumb. And we have these charts in our report. This company has an awful lot of bad debt relative to its peers. Its clients are some of the best credit quality companies in the world. A lot of them are large tech companies, but pretty much all the, I shouldn't say all, but most of this company's revenues come from big companies that can afford to provide really fancy perks like fertility benefits, special fertility benefits to their employees. We don't think those companies are defaulting on their payments. We don't think that the consumers, the members, make up enough of the revenues to drive such large bad debt expenses. And so our guess is that this is actually more creative accounting being used to bury overstated revenues and gross profits. And here's why. Progyny doesn't send the bill to Facebook, per se. Progyny is billing the insurance companies who reimburse Progyny for services covered under, let's say, Facebook's, I'm using Facebook as an example, but under Facebook's insurance plan. Now, if Progyny were to send a bill to an insurance company for, saying, we have this claim, we want you to reimburse us for this, we've paid the provider for it, and the insurance company denies that claim, our opinion is that that Progyny may be recording that as a bad debt expense. And we don't know this. It doesn't say this anywhere. They don't really provide you a lot of information about what's in those bad debt expenses. But what we feel comfortable saying is that it doesn't make sense that these are just customers refusing to pay. Now, the reason this seems like an accounting game to us is it's so consistently high. And if this company periodically had a few claims being denied here or there, it would sort of, maybe that can happen. But it's consistent, right? Close to around, it's around 2% of revenues just about every quarter. I mean, 1% to 2% pretty much every quarter for a long time now. And we think that, you would know eventually if your Progyny which services are covered and which aren't. So what would you do if you wanted to inflate your revenues and inflate your gross profits? You might over-recognize those revenues. And then, again, this is our theory because Progyny, we looked and they don't talk about this anywhere. But we think that this is a result of them recognizing revenues that their clients' insurers will never reimburse Progyny for. Now, alternatively, another possibility is that this could be a byproduct of getting rid of those cancellation allowances that we talked about before, where now when customers cancel, it hits your SG&A instead of your gross margins. And, you might say, well, if they have to recognize an expense anyway, what good does it do? It doesn't change their bottom line. The reason that we think that Progyny might be doing something like this could be that they want to inflate their revenues and their gross profits because that's what growth investors care about. They want to see that this company is going to grow its gross profits over time because the common belief among growth investors is that, well, SG&A expenses are fixed. And so you get operating leverage. And so we don't need to focus on SG&A. So if you have bad debt that's below the gross profit line, it inflates the numbers that your investors care about. And so this is a little bit more complicated than the other accounting games that we think they're playing. But this is the best explanation we could come up for. Now, I will say, let's just say we're wrong. Let's say that this bad debt expense is not an accounting game. Let's just say it's real traditional bad debt expense. That closes one door and opens another one. And the other one is really ugly too, because we don't, again, this company has really high credit quality corporate customers. We believe, based on our research, only a single digit percentage of its revenues are from members, from consumers, out of pocket deductible that they owe the company that we talked about. So let's just say that 4%, pick that, we don't know the number, but we know it's small. Let's say it's 4% of your revenues come from members out of pockets. Well, 4% of your revenues come from members out of pockets, and that's where the defaults are happening. And the defaults are 2% of your revenues. That means that would imply that your members are defaulting at a 50% rate. We don't see how that's possible, but if that's what it is, then this is an extremely, you can call it extreme subprime. And we've been in a Goldilocks consumer economy where consumer defaults, credit card defaults, we have this in our report, have been extremely low. And they've just only now started to normalize. So what happens to extreme subprime credits when default rates across the economy go from all-time low to just normal? Bad debt expenses, we think in that scenario, would get a lot worse. And the company has only a single-digit operating margin. So this is a long way of saying, we think the bad debt expenses are symptomatic of an accounting game, but we're not entirely sure. And if it's not what we think, then it's just a horrible bad debt problem that the company really needs to explain, because it looks nothing like either of two peer groups. So I apologize that that's a little bit more of a complicated scenario to explain, but we think it's either really bad or it's something else really bad.
No, that was really helpful. And I just want to sort of revisit that just to make sure that I understand it correctly as how you explained it. And basically what you believe is happening is instead of the company lowering, say, its revenue projections or actual reported revenues, which would be horrendous for growth investors that are looking for that revenue growth, right? I mean, we're trying to grab market share, this long runway to massive growth. So instead of taking that route where, you know, if they're not receiving these reimbursements, you probably shouldn't be recognizing that revenue in the first place. So instead of lowering your revenue and your projections, they're simply moving those into the bad debts, which are much further down on, you know, the financial statements where a lot of people just don't even pay attention to them. So is that correct?
Yeah. So that is, it's, that's what we think. Okay. You know, again, this is a little bit harder to prove. What we know is that the numbers make no sense from a variety of perspectives. And if what we're describing is, you know, if our theory is correct, it would make perfect sense that what you just described is the reason they would be doing it. And, you know, as a sort of a funny aside, but very relevant, there's a report out by Barclays where the analyst actually says, you know, one of the things we like about this company is it has almost no bad debt expense because their customers are such high credit quality and so few of their you know, payments come from members. Now, you know, we think, I mean, it just, the most charitable explanation you could come up with for why an analyst, a professional research analyst would write that is that they didn't open the cash flow statement to look at what the bad debt expense was, right? That's the most charitable explanation. But the point of me telling you that story is that's how bad, you know, you can't say that and get away with it and have nobody notice it if people are paying attention to the bad debt expense. We just don't think anybody's paying attention to it. You'd much rather have investors think that you, like, your SG&A is a little bit higher than your COGS is because your cost of revenues, bad debt expense, if it's what we think it is, that's a variable expense. It's not going to scale. It's going to just, if revenues double, bad debt expense will double. Gross margins will not go up. You know, it's really not a good, it's just not a good situation to be in. And there are incentives, we think, for a company to sort of say, well, you know what, our revenues are all legitimate. We just got these random bad debt expenses. Hey, don't focus on those. So
I think that's a good time to pivot to your last point here, which is the addressable market. I mean, you talked about the large tech companies being some of its primary clients, but what does the company say in terms of its addressable market? And what has your research found is more realistic?
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about a variety of issues with this total addressable market. I think the simplest part of our argument is just that most companies, the vast majority of companies are not realistic fits for this service. You know, what the company says, I believe the most recent number is that they say that there's about 8,000 self-insured companies in the US, and that's their total addressable market. And they make these wonderful projections of, you know, this is the 8,000 companies have this many employees, and, you know, you can do your own math as to what percentage of those employees will get, and everything looks roses. You know, when we spoke to industry players about this, and also it's sort of common sense once you think about it, you know, we spoke to a former employee, we spoke to a direct competitor who's in the same business, you know, they all told us it's hard to make money serving companies of 1,000 employees or 2,000 employees, you know, maybe even 5,000 employees. A direct competitor actually said that they were skeptical of Progyny's ability, and I think this implies their ability to make, the competitor's ability to make money serving companies with 5,000 employees, because the benefit gets utilized by only very small fractions of the employee base. You can't roll this service out of your company if nobody's going to use it, but it costs Progyny money to stand up a new relationship with that company. So let's just say that, you know, a company with 10 people, they're probably never, you know, the percentage of employees who use this service is so small that company of 10 people is never going to use, almost certainly never going to use this product. They're never going to go out and get IVF cycles. It's, I forget the numbers, the estimates vary, but it's from like 0.5%, 1%, 2% utilization rates. So with the employee count of 10, it's just never going to get used, but it still costs Progyny money to go out and sell that client. Progyny employees will need to go to benefit fairs to explain this to people. There's costs associated with standing up new clients. You know, multiple experts that we spoke to, former employee, et cetera, told us that Progyny can go win these clients, but they just can't make money doing it. what that tells you is that the addressable market, unless Progyny just wants to go out and lose money hand over fist, which they're already doing, but if they want to do it in a more obvious way, they can go out and sign up tiny little companies. But it's not like companies of 10 people are the only ones that are small enough. You know, we calculate that something like, well, the U.S. government, like the Federal Reserve, puts out information about how many companies there are in the U.S. of certain sizes. There's nowhere remotely near 8,000 companies in this country that have over a few thousand employees. So the there's more problems with the TAM argument, but this is the one, it's one of my favorites because it's so simple, right? You can just look at the companies that are a fit for this. You have to cut out all the companies that would either they would never sign up for this benefit or Progyny can never make money doing it. They'll lose money signing these customers up. You have to exclude those from the TAM. There's a lot of other things you need to exclude from the TAM, but that, and that, you know, that's the way we set up the arguments in our report as to, you know, why the TAM is just grossly overstated. Once you cut down the TAM, you have to start revisiting your growth assumptions. And this is a highly valued, expensive company trading at an enormous multiple of its own revenues. In our report, we talk about how this company uses principal accounting. So there's principal versus agent accounting. They include all of the revenues that go to their provider clinics as they report that as their revenue. It's right there in our report. We snapshot that. We take that language directly from the company's own accounting language. So when you see $100 of Progyny revenue, the vast majority of that, you can think of it as a pass-through. That Progyny goes and takes that money and just they give most of it to the healthcare provider. So $100 of revenue on Progyny's top line is not $100 of economically revenue that we believe Progyny economically owns. But when people talk about this company's EV to revenue, they're talking about EV to total revenues. You need to haircut that by like 80%. So this is an enormously expensive company on an EV to true revenues basis. The reason I say all that is because you have to believe that this company is going to grow to the sky and that the TAM is enormous to want to pay that kind of revenue multiple for a company. And the revenue multiple is wrong, and so is the TAM. So it really presents problems if people understand what that means.
Do you have any sort of idea what the potential TAM is? I mean, I know you mentioned the Federal Reserve's own database. I mean, is there more like 2,000 companies that, you know, would qualify as having 2,500 or more employees? Do you have any sort of idea with that?
We do when we go through that in our report. I don't want to be too specific because we kind of talk about it as ranges.
Okay.
But I think as a starting point, let's just make it very simple and something that people who don't want to bother to read our report can sort of just conceptually think of. You could start by cutting the TAM in half and go from there. It's really ugly if you do that, but you could just start there. There's, you know, we have other arguments around why the TAM is overstated. I mean, one of them, for instance, is that some of the projections that the sell side makes, so this is not the company going out saying this, but there's some sell side reports out there where they sort of do this analysis of how many IVF cycles, treatment cycles can happen in the United States, how many births can be done by IVF. And if you look at that and say, oh, what percentage of all births in the U.S. would that have to be? It implies percentages that are similar to what you see in countries like Denmark or Israel, where IVF is essentially free. Unless you think that we're going to do more, you know, IVF cycles than they do per capita in places where IVF is just free, the government pays for it, then you kind of have to haircut the TAM by that as well. So it's that type of argument, that would go into this, you know, looking at this and saying, let's actually question this, right? People talk about this TAM, sell-side analysts talk about it. Let's actually just take a minute to think about it and understand it. And it doesn't hold up well under the microscope.
All right. So now for my favorite part of the discussion, which is catalysts. Are there any sort of hard fixed catalysts, or is it more so you see sort of conditions developing over time?
I think it's more the latter. You know, it's not like we're saying, hey, this particular quarter or that particular quarter, they're going to miss. You know, the accounting games that they're playing, we think it's getting harder for them to find new accounting games. And those are going to, you have to get bigger and bigger and more aggressive to keep up the appearance of the same growth and stability. This is where the vast majority of the companies that we've been short on theses like this have gotten into troubles when the accounting games just run out. So that's part of it. It's a little harder to triangulate when that's going to happen. However, we also think that in 2023, things are going to get a lot tougher for progeny because the tech industry and other sort of industries that have really benefited from cheap money and feeling like they can spend unlimited amounts of money in a cheap money world. The tech industry is a great example of this. What Facebook and Amazon and Twitter are doing, they're looking at their businesses and saying, oh, you know what? We have to start thinking about expenses. You know, maybe Facebook says they want to cover 2 IVF cycles of progeny instead of 3. You won't see companies just totally bailing on fertility benefits, we don't think. What you'll see is them cutting the fat and asking, do we need to provide this much of a luxury perk? You know, if a company says, hey, if a company wants to be able to say we provide fertility benefits to their employees, they don't need to offer, I believe Facebook is offering 4 IVF cycles, which is just, that's extremely generous. And in most cases, not necessary. We don't think Facebook's going to harm its recruiting prospects by cutting that back to 2 or 3 cycles. That's really bad for progeny, but we don't think it would hurt Facebook's, you know, appeal to employees. The other aspect of this is that we've been living in a world of labor shortages and super low unemployment. Competition for talent has been extremely tight. And so companies have been throwing resources at anything they can to attract more employees. Everything from free lunches and granola bars in the kitchens and all that sort of thing to yoga studios, gourmet coffee, and fertility benefits. And all these things cost money. And to the extent that these companies start thinking about not spending money gratuitously, they may actually have to say, okay, fine. Like, what are we really doing here with these fertility benefits? And we found at least one example of one large tech company, PayPal. They didn't get rid of progeny, but they changed the member obligation to effectively shift more of that cost onto the member. It's things like that that signal to us that customers are becoming more discerning about how much they spend on these fertility benefits, and sharpening the pencil essentially on how much they cost. This is a function of just where the macro economy is today and where it's going. I don't think too many people would dispute that the tech industry is sort of having a reckoning about costs. That's not where progeny wants to be at all.
Right. And I think you're seeing a lot of that recently with, you know, Twitter announcing a whole bunch of layoffs, Meta, I think 10 or 11,000, Amazon, a lot of these companies are starting to announce a layoff. So to your point, kind of where we are in the macroeconomic cycle. But even if, say, these companies don't scale back, you know, if Facebook doesn't go from 4 IVF to 2 IVF, isn't there still a component where these layoffs should in the end affect sort of the end market for progeny, right? Because if, say, Facebook goes from 100,000 employees to, you know, a couple rounds of layoffs to say 50,000 employees, does that change the outlook for progeny in terms of what they can draw from a client like Facebook?
It does, but, you know, in fairness to the company, we think that that's probably not the main driver of, you know, reduced economics for progeny. Because, you know, yes, if Facebook goes from 100,000 employees to 50,000, that's terrible for progeny. I'm not sure that we'd feel comfortable calling for those types of draconian drops. It could be more like a 5% drop in employee count. What that means, however, is, you know, compare this to where we were a year ago. You know, in 2021, these companies couldn't couldn't get enough talent. They couldn't hire enough people. There was inflation, there was labor shortages. These companies had to offer just ridiculous perks just to get people to look at them. They don't have to do that anymore. And so now they can go, they have the ability, the negotiating leverage to go back and say, okay, you know what? We're not in hiring mode. Maybe we're not laying off 20% of our employee workforce, but we are reevaluating all these perks that we give to people. We're just tightening our belts a little bit. The fertility benefits are important, and it's a great thing to have employees be able to access them. And we don't think Facebook's going to stop having fertility benefits. We do think they're going to be a lot more price conscious, and that's actually something we've seen in our field work. We've consistently been hearing when we spoke to a competitor, we spoke to a former employee, we spoke to a consultant. You know, 5-6 years ago, progeny was basically the only game in town to do these point solutions. Not exactly the only game in town, but there was not much of a competitive field for a really high quality, carved out point solution. And that's what progeny is. And it's a great offering if your company has it. It's really nice to be covered by that. But fast forward to 2022, there's a number of companies that do it. Carrot, Maven, Kindbody, et cetera. A lot of companies that didn't exist a few years ago, now they're doing it. And, you know, we're told that they're competing on price. As much as anything else, price is a very important component of this. So it's not necessarily that Facebook says, we don't care about our employees anymore. We don't want to cover their fertility benefits. We hope they do continue to cover fertility benefits, and they need to do that. They probably should do that economically, but they don't have to pay as much for it. They don't have to cover as many benefits for it. And it will matter a lot more to them now than it did a year ago, who can do it the cheapest. That's where we think the problem lies. Yes, if they cut their workforce in half, that's another type of problem. I'm just not sure that I don't think we expect. I mean, God, I hope that's not happening. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually a really interesting point to come back to when we were previously talking about the TAM, right? And now you bring up sort of the upstart competitors. Is the rationale behind, you know, how can margins be so attractive in this industry, according to Progyny and the growth projections, and a lot of the big players not being involved, right? I mean, this is kind of like a niche market where why wouldn't, if it was such a large growth driver, why wouldn't an Aetna or Humana step in and say, okay, you know, we'll either buy you or we'll just do this ourselves?
You have picked up on something that, you know, sometimes I put my accounting hat so far down my head that it covers my eyes. And I should have talked about that sooner in this discussion. That's a big part of understanding of how this company works. And it's a big question for us. And we've consistently come back to this answer that it's actually not really an attractive business. Because if it were, Aetna would focus more on it. You know, Aetna, you know, as we understand it, covers these fertility benefits, right? Cigna covers them. It's not like Progyny is just, you know, it's not like a greenfield. Progyny will tell you 50% of the contracts that they've won over the years have been takeaways from other insurance companies. We think the issue here is that insurance companies these benefits are not economically attractive to the insurers. There's a reason for that. Now, Progyny's been able to grow dramatically, generate a lot of revenues, and issue, you know, executives have gotten very rich on this, and they're selling stock like crazy, and they're still doing it, actually. But that doesn't make it a good business, or even a business that can viably sustain a profit. So I think you're absolutely right. It sort of begs the question, like, why don't the insurance companies do this? They can. They absolutely can. They've chosen not to invest the necessary resources to do that. If Aetna wants to get serious about covering fertility benefits and do it in a more humane and user-friendly way because they think it's a good business, they will do that. I don't believe they think that. And that's why they're letting Progyny have this business.
Well, that's a great point. To try to get you to give us one more summary, because I know we've covered a lot here today. So just to help us wrap our heads around everything we discussed, if you could give one more summary of the key points behind why you think Progyny is a good short idea.
We started with the accounting games. You know, in our opinion, these accounting games are inflating revenues, they're inflating profits and profit margins, and they're inflating cash flows. We think that secretive, very subtle, quiet, but important accounting policy changes have also been done to keep these numbers afloat. They've been done more recently to keep these numbers afloat. And investors should be ask the company, what have the impacts of these accounting changes been? We have it in our report, go through, find that change and say, what's the impact? Do the math yourself before you ask them this question. Otherwise, they could mislead you. We also think that the bad debt in this company is just out of control. It makes no sense. We think it's an accounting game. We're happy to be wrong about that, because if bad debt is just bad debt, that's another completely terrible situation. And the company should really have to explain, where's all this bad debt expense coming from? Who is not paying you? And then additionally, we think the total addressable market is just a fantasy, and therefore so are the growth prospects. And then this all ties together fundamentally. This is a business that just, it shouldn't exist, or if it should exist, it should exist as a charity. Because what they're doing is very nice. We just don't think they can really make any money doing it. Maybe at times they might, a quarter or two, they might eke out a profit. But you just step back and analyze the accounting and also analyze the fundamentals of this industry. We just don't think there's any profit to be had here long term. It's not for investors. It's for, you know, it's a charity. It's a beautiful thing. But you won't make any money owning the stock, is our opinion, if you're a long-term holder.
Well, JR, as usual, it's been great catching up with you. And as always, you've done a terrific job laying out a solid short thesis here on Progyny. So thanks again for your time, and look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Yeah, of course, Mike. It's been great talking to you. Thanks for having us back.